welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. We celebrate President's Day this week, and to help us mark the occasion, we have invited back to our show the National Book Award-winning author and historian, Joseph Ellis. Professor Ellis will be talking with Fred Nielsen about the lives of the major figures of the nation's founding generation, which is also the subject of Ellis's latest book. But before we hear from Joseph Ellis, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week in 1878, Thomas Alva Edison patented the phonograph, astonishing those who could not conceive of the feat of recording sound. Edison epitomized the turn-of-the-century industrial America's prolific genius. Known to the world as the Wizard of Menlo Park, Edison's humble origins, his deafness since early childhood, and his lack of formal education pointed to anything but success. Nevertheless, at the age of 17, he began offering the world hundreds of inventions that today we take for granted, but at the time established his reputation for genius. In his very own invention factory in Newark, New Jersey, and in the nation's first modern research laboratory in nearby West Orange, Edison supervised the work of 80 chemists, physicists, and mathematicians, and over the course of 40 years patented over 300 inventions, some of the most notable being the incandescent electric lamp, the first central electric-like power plant, the motion picture camera, and the phonograph, which was his most original and profitable invention. But Edison was also a man of good humor, who did not hesitate to lampoon his own image as a genius. The man who dressed carelessly, clowned for reporters, and scoffed at formal education, summed up his supposed genius by explaining that genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, after the great Native American athlete Jim Thorpe died in 1953, his body was effectively sold by his third wife, Patricia Askew Thorpe, to the town of Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania. Thorpe's three sons are now demanding the return of their father's remains for proper American Indian burial in Oklahoma. One of the greatest athletes in American history, who excelled in football, baseball, and track and field, Thorpe never set foot in the little Pennsylvania mining town that bears his name and burial place. For the first time, the story of the Vietnamese girl caught in a napalm attack and whose image was captured in one of the most famous photographs to come out of the Vietnam War is being told. It is presented through an assemblage of 26 photographs displayed at the George Eastman House in Rochester, New York. Entitled The Girl in the Picture, the exhibit will be open to the public until June 3, 2001. The 9-year-old girl depicted running, blistered and screaming down a road bombarded by American airplanes in 1972 Pulitzer Prize-winning photo is now 37 and living in Canada. This is Talking History.
I oh, do you know the names of the U.S. residents who then became the president and got a view from the White House to a Pennsylvania Avenue? George Washington was the first, you see. He once chopped down a cherry tree. President number two was B. John Adams, and then number three. Tom Jefferson stayed up to write the Constitution late at night. So he and his wife had a great big fight, and she made him sleep on the couch all night.
Perhaps the citizen soldiers who came out of the Depression to win World War II were America's greatest generation, as we've been told recently. But before Americans could become democratic citizens, they needed leaders who were firmly committed to the cause of national independence and popular government. In that sense, the nation's greatest generation was its first. And that generation is the subject of Fred Nielsen's interview this week with historian Joseph Ellis.
Joseph Ellis, professor of history at Mount Holyoke College, is one of the leading historians of the American Revolution and early Republic. In 1997, he received the National Book Award for American Sphinx, The Character of Thomas Jefferson. His latest book, Founding Brothers, provides portraits of the nation's founding generation, Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Franklin, Hamilton, and Aaron Burr, a group he calls America's greatest political generation. Professor Ellis, welcome to Talking History.
Thank you for inviting me, Mr. Niels.
Why was this, in your view, America's greatest generation?
Oh, gee, you start with the toughest question of all. Because they represented a level of political talent that addressed the most serious crisis in all of American history, even more serious than the Civil War, and managed to create a body of or a set of political institutions which still endure and which still govern the oldest republic in modern history. Pretty tough to beat that.
Well, you write that the 1790s, the decade that comprises most of your book, was the most crucial and consequential decade in American history, even surpassing, in your view, the 1860s and the 1940s. Why were the 1790s so important?
Well, I try to use the 1790s as a kind of middle perch and to look back to the Revolution and then forward into the 19th century. And I'm trying to suggest that while the Revolution is an event that occurs in 1776 and is the declaration of American independence from Britain, and that the Constitutional Convention of 1787 and ratification in 1788 established the American nation, and those are the two great founding moments, that what the original intent of the Revolution was and what the meaning of the Constitution was still very much up in the air. And it was in the 1790s that the various groups that had different notions as to what we meant by independence and what we meant by the American Republic collided and colluded in the political life of the nation in the 1790s and eventually established what we call political parties, but that the cacophonous and scatological character of the debate in the 1790s shows that what we really were doing in the Revolution was not founding America on a proposition, which Jefferson wrote, the one that says we hold these truths to be self-evident, but rather founding ourselves on an argument about what that proposition means.
In fact, you make the point that that argument itself has become institutionalized. It's not so much Jefferson's proposition, the glittering generalities that we hew to, but a persistent argument about what the Revolution, both founding moments, actually meant.
That's right. It's possible to sort of dramatize the argument as an argument between Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, representing different sides of the debate. I like to see it also as a kind of debate between Jefferson and Adams. But it's not a simple argument. It's not monolithic. It's an argument about the relative power of the federal government over the states. It's an argument about the relative importance of freedom against equality. It's an argument about whether individual freedom should take precedence over the abiding needs of the collective. And even in the recent presidential campaign, whereas Al Gore is arguing that the federal government is us, George W. Bush has argued that the federal government is them. And that's a kind of maybe overly clever way to describe one of the fundamental basis of this argument, which first gets going in the late 18th century and in some sense has made American history, perhaps like all history, a kind of argument without end.
You make the point about the 1790s, I think in particular in regard to one of the presidential elections, that there was simply no consensus at all about what the American Revolution meant or what the Constitution had settled. And you write that the Federalists, the party of Hamilton and Adams, and the Republicans, the party of Jefferson and Madison, were afloat in a sea of mutual accusation and partisan interpretation. You conclude by saying the center could not hold because it did not exist.
That's right. I wouldn't say that there was absolutely no consensus at all. There was a consensus that they wanted to establish a republican form of government, that they were doing away with monarchy, and that they were striking out on a fundamentally new direction that no modern state had ever pursued before. They all agreed on that. But what the powers of the presidency ought to be, what the role of the federal government ought to be over American domestic policy, and what the foreign policy of the United States ought to be, especially with regard to Europe, all those things were absolutely undecided and up in the air. And those are the central arguments and the central issues that the founding brothers clash over in the 1790s. And I call them brothers rather than fathers, because I think fathers distances us from them. It makes them seem demigodish, omniscient, and I want to talk about them more as they thought of themselves. They thought of themselves, and they called themselves a band of brothers, with all of the affection and rivalry that goes with that kind of language.
I was intrigued by the change from fathers to brothers and all that that implied. It seemed to me that one of the themes of the book, subtly made but repeatedly made, is that in different ways, everyone's vision is cloudy. They knew they were making history, but they couldn't know exactly what that history would be. For our part, we're not even sure about some of the simplest details. You begin by recounting the duel between Burr and Hamilton, which should be pretty straightforward, but you note that even there, some of the basic facts are in dispute.
That's right. I mean, it's a mystery still because they're clashing pieces of evidence that argue in different directions there, and I'm trying to offer a kind of sensible and commonsensical explanation. It's pretty much like a Agatha Christie mystery story. But with regard to your basic point, I think that as we look back at the American Revolution, it looks inevitable. It was a success, and we're the beneficiaries of that success. In fact, no event in American history, in retrospect, looks as inevitable as this one, as that one. From their point of view, however, it was one of the most improbable events of all history. That is, how a small group of 13 colonies that had never cooperated in any significant way before could manage to defeat the major naval and military power in the world, Britain, and could then go on to create a republican form of government over a landmass which everybody in Europe regarded as incapable of being governed in such a fashion. So that both the winning of the revolution per se and the establishment of a republican nation, both of those events were unprecedented. And if you were standing on the ground in the late 18th century and taking bets as to whether this enterprise was going to succeed, I think you could have gotten odds of like 1 in 10,000. So as they experienced the revolution, it was a series of contingencies. They were improvising on the edge of catastrophe. And it was a miracle, not in any supernatural sense of the term, that they were successful. And I'm trying to suggest that they were successful because that collective, not any one of them, but that collective called the Founding Fathers, or as I call them, brothers, managed to interact in a dynamic way and produce the institutions that endured.
There are seven brothers, eight people, if one throws in John Adams' collaborator, his wife Abigail. Could you say a few words about what some of the contributions, the strengths and weaknesses of those individuals were?
Sure. I mean, I think that Washington is the closest thing to the one indispensable figure. Without Washington, both as the leader of the Continental Army and as the first president, it's very difficult to imagine the Union holding together. He was the combination of Moses, Cincinnatus, all rolled into one. A man of action rather than of words. There are no words on the Washington Monument, but in my view, probably, as I've read all the papers of all these people, the one who's the most statesmanlike and most impressive. Alexander Hamilton is the most brilliant. In my view, probably would have gotten the highest scores on the SATs. Also the most dangerous, the person who is capable of boldness that at times threatens the very republican institutions that we hold dear.
More dangerous even than Burr?
Not quite as dangerous as Burr, and Burr is the most dangerous person. I think that one of the reasons that Hamilton and Burr meet on the plains of Weehawken in the famous duel is that they recognize in each other some of the same Napoleonic instincts that they feel inside themselves. I think that Franklin is the wisest, man who kind of floats above all the political factions with an ease and a geniality. He's the oldest. He's the grandfather amongst the fathers, and the one with the greatest sense of timing. Chooses to make his last act a strong statement against slavery, and a plea that that they put in a constitutional amendment, if you will, to put slavery on the road to extinction. Madison is the lawyer's founder, the one who is excellent in the details of any particular political problem, also the most artful political manipulator, I think, inside the Congress, an acolyte of Jefferson. And Jefferson is, I think, the visionary, the one who is not a great political philosopher, but is a great political visionary, meaning a kind of prophet And the rhetorician of the American Revolution, the man whose lyrical language floats above it all and allows us now to marvel, he, along with, I think, Lincoln, are the two great poets of American political history. Who did I forget? Adams. How could I forget him?
Your man.
He's my favorite one. He's my favorite because he's the most honest and the most candid in his diaries and in his letters. He shows you not just what he's thinking, but what he's feeling. He exposes himself, his ambitions, his vanities, his all of his urges, in a way that he provides the fullest window into the kind of psychological life of that generation. I think that what Adams spoke honestly about, all of them were feeling it one way or another. And I think his relationship with Abigail is also the most fully revealed partnership between a man and a woman in the late 18th century. And it is really a full partnership, too. She is an equal partner in his career and in his life. And the letters exchanged between them, as I say, afford us the clearest window into a marriage in that period.
Your book's last chapter focuses on the letters exchanged over a period of several years between Adams, John Adams, and Thomas Jefferson. After their political estrangement, they were brought together again in, I believe, 1812?
That's right. They exchanged about 158 letters between 1812 and their mutual death, which is a kind of unbelievable providential act. If you made it up, no one would believe it. They both died, as many people now know, on July 4th, the 50th anniversary to the day of the publication of the Declaration of Independence.
One of the things they were doing in this last great epistolary project was to explain themselves to each other, as they said, but also to, in this final act, explore for themselves and for posterity the meanings of the American Revolution. What positions did Adams and Jefferson take in these last letters?
I think you're right. I think that this exchange of letters is a classic set of letters, perhaps the single most impressive group exchange of correspondence between American statesmen in all of American history. And they're really trying to talk to each other honestly, now that they're past their prime and readying themselves for the grave, about what they did and what the American Revolution meant. And what comes out, and they're trying to be diplomatic about it. It's a bit of a verbal minuet here, because they don't want to do harm to the friendship. Adams really thinks that the American Revolution was a set of fortunate events that were in some sense a matter of luck. Adams is the kind of person who says that a third of the American people supported the revolution, a third opposed it, and a third tried to stay neutral. Mm-hmm. He doesn't see it as something that had the full support of the American people. Jefferson tends to see it as a kind of inevitable unfolding of what he calls Whig principles. Later generations will call Democratic principles, though they're not quite the same thing. And he sees it as something that is foreordained. Adams sees it as something that was made by men, by them, by the Band of Brothers. And I tend in the book to agree more with Adams' view than with Jefferson's.
I was going to ask about that. It seemed as though when Adams talks about contingency, uncertainty, divisiveness, inherent messiness, you are in a sense agreeing with him.
I am. He's offering a kind of what contemporary historians might call a deconstructed view of the revolution. Like in Tolstoy's War and Peace, you write about a battle and it makes all kinds of sense in retrospect, but if you're a participant in the battle, it seems like sheer chaos, and everything that is offered as a kind of cogent interpretation in the afterworld is really an imposition. I tend to agree with Adams's explanation of the revolution as something that could easily have gone in fundamentally different directions. And Adams really makes human agency, the role of particular people, very, very important. He also wants to destroy the notion that any one person, whether it was Washington or Jefferson, is the most responsible and for the success. Part of it is that Adams is jealous of Jefferson and jealous to some extent of Washington as well, and he wants to sort of smash all the statues that might be constructed in American pantheon because he's not sure that he's going to be included among them. He says that, monuments and mausoleums will never be erected to me, and thus far he's proven correct. I think that Adams's view is less flattering. It makes the revolution less romantic. It makes it more of a messy kind of achievement. Jefferson's view is, as I say, more romantic and more a matter of inevitability, and a lot of Americans are attracted to that kind of interpretation.
We are unfortunately out of time, Professor Ellis, but thank you so much for speaking with us today.
It's been my pleasure.
We've been listening to Joseph Ellis, author of Founding Brothers, The Revolutionary Generation.
This land is yours. This land is mine. From California to New York, from the Redwood Forest and off stream water, this land is you and me.
The recent presidential election, the most complex and controversial on record, is destined to become one of the most intensively studied elections in history. The focus of much of that research will be on the Florida ballots. But what is the future of those much maligned ballots? Will they be saved? And if so, where? That is the subject of this week's op-ed by Bruce Craig, director of the National Coordinating Committee for the Promotion of History.
For a majority of Americans, the legitimacy of George W. Bush's election to the American presidency is destined to remain an unsettled and unsettling question. In years to come, we can expect to see hundreds of articles and books flowing from the pens of historians and other researchers, all seeking to put to rest the still unanswered question, who really won the popular vote in the disputed presidential election in Florida, and at the center of the controversy, the ballots themselves. In order to definitively answer that question for the American people, Congress should step in and subpoena the Florida ballots, dimples, pimples, and all. Congress should also act to save the other related documentary evidence of that state's election, such as instructions and email communications between the Florida Secretary of State's office and the local election boards. All the records should then be turned over to the National Archives in Washington, D.C. to ensure their long-term preservation. Under normal circumstances, ballots cast during a presidential election remain the property of individual states. In Florida, state law charges counties to preserve ballots for a minimum of 22 months, after which they may be destroyed. Clearly, the historical record is at risk. The historical record ought to be saved, and there are several options to weigh if these documents are to be preserved. First, the Florida Department of State could request that local governments voluntarily transfer the ballots to the state archives for consolidated permanent retention. But state officials plan to take no action to consolidate the ballots for at least 22 months, and after that, given the highly charged political atmosphere in Florida, it's unclear what action, if any, professional archivists would be permitted or, in fact, would take to preserve the documentary record. Second, Congress or the archivist of the United States could request the state of Florida to voluntarily transfer the ballots to the National Archives. This option is problematic, since there is some question whether state law permits officials to turn state records over to the federal government without the approval of the governor, the legislature, or both, and this seems unlikely. The third option is to subpoena and thereby federalize the records. To this end, now that the new Congress is in session, one of their first actions should be to create a special congressional investigatory panel to review the documentary record relating to the hotly contested election of 2000. It could be roughly modeled after the U.S. Assassination Records Review Board, the independent bipartisan entity established by Congress back in 1992 that settled lingering questions relating to the controversy surrounding the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It is in the national interest to preserve the integrity of the documentary record for the nation's posterity. The American people want to ensure that someday the entire historical record relating to the disputed election in Florida will be available for anybody to study. Certainly, every citizen deserves to learn the whole story of this, one of the most important and controversial elections in American history. Let's preserve the historical record and let the documents themselves speak to future generations.
You've been listening to Bruce Craig, director of the National Coordinating Committee for the Promotion of History. Craig's op-ed comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. And this is Talking History.
Well, you must
To the victor goes the spoils, it has been said, and the losers simply disappear, their stories seldom told. That has certainly been true of losers in the race for the presidency, until now, that is, and until one small Kansas border town decided to change that. Here to tell you about a museum dedicated to those who lost is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Instead of a Hall of Fame, the also-ran museum in the small Kansas town of Norton has the losers of presidential elections. The museum is housed in the First State Bank, where portraits of former presidents like Nixon and Hoover, both one-time runners-up, hang alongside those of lesser-known also-rans like Rufus King and Winfield Hancock. Al Gore is the 57th such runner-up to be included in the collection. Biographical sketches of each of the candidates are included with the photos. Many include more than just the facts about the person in the campaign. They include commentary as well, provided by the founder of the museum, W.W. Rouse, who created the exhibit after reading They Also Ran. The small museum has a lot of history lining its walls, so next time you're passing through northern Kansas near the Nebraska border and you see the sign for Norton, take the time to stop and see the Also Ran Museum.
Turning to our list of coming attractions, the History Channel will be offering some interesting programs in the next few weeks that we'd like to call to your attention. On February 27th, look for The Best Kept Secret, the story of D-Day and the Allies' successful Operation Overlord, the million-man invasion of Normandy that cracked the Nazi Atlantic defense in World War II. On March 2nd, tune in Free a Man to Fight, a history of the role of women who enlisted in the military to defend their country during World War II, what they did and how the experience changed their lives. And on March 3rd, watch for Black Aviators Flying Free. It tells the story of African Americans who defied the odds and overcame discrimination to fly in World War I and every American war since. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact showtimes of these History Channel programs. And that's it for another week of Talking History, but before we close, I'd like to offer you the chance to have your favorite book, topic, or historic site discussed on our show. Let us know what book you would like us to discuss, what subject you're interested in having us take up, or what historic site you would recommend to recall to our listeners' attention. And if we use your suggestion, we'll send you a special gift. All you need to do is send us your suggestion either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. And be sure to include the call letters and location of the radio station where you listen to Talking History. Until next week, when we'll examine the history of Jack the Ripper from the studios of KIOS in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.